Brother Carl has an interesting topic he's chosen, and it's entitled The Challenge of the Fourth Generation. The Challenge of the Fourth Generation. Brother Carl.
Several years ago, about 20 years old, I gave a discourse called The Hazards of the Third Generation. Well, this talk has already changed because a generation has passed by on that since then. Now we're in the fourth generation. So our title is The Challenge of the Fourth Generation. We would like to start out by noticing a certain repetitive pattern that develops with almost any person who comes along with a prominent idea, a movement, a reform, and then how it develops over the following generations. Usually in the cycle, we find the first generation is a generation of vision. They see an object, they see a goal in life, and become totally absorbed in accomplishing that. There's a message to be given. There's a movement to be made. And they form not so much a sect or cult, but a movement. The second generation, when the leader of the first generation dies, usually goes into power struggle. Who's going to carry the torch next? And there's usually a battle between the various factions as who carries it, and it ends up with a division, and sometimes two or three divisions in the same time. Thus, the third generation comes in and is disillusioned. It finds that what has gone before them has discouraged them from the zeal of the first generation. Second generation has discouraged them, disillusioned them, and strife turns out, and the divisions multiply into more divisions. And then the fourth generation is far enough back now they've lost contact with the first generation. They accept the status quo, and the movement, the reform that was there, becomes just another denomination. We're going to look at this cycle seven times in the Bible. In the case of Adam, Noah, Moses, David, Jesus, the Reformers, and Pastor Russell. We want to see how this pattern holds true in each of these generations. In the case of Adam, we find that the third generation is in the side of Abel, it's Enos. And Cain's side is Mahujael. So we say, what happened with Enos? What do we know about Enos? We know one thing about Enos. It's given to us in Genesis 4:26. To Seth, to him also there was born a son, and he called his name Enos. Then men began to call upon the name of the Lord. Genesis 4:26. That's odd. Then men began to call upon the name of the Lord. Didn't Abel call upon the name of the Lord? Didn't Cain try calling on the name of the Lord? The Lord was not first called upon in the days of Enos and his son. It was called upon before that. We suggest the thought is a mistranslation. The marginal reading reads, then men began to call themselves by the name of the Lord. Notice in the case of the Cain generations, there's a certain thing about the last name which becomes prominent in following generations. It ends with two letters, E-L. E-L means God. Mahujael is the first person to have the name of God in his name. He began to be called by the name of God. His name is smitten by God. Enos' son was Methuselah, and that name became prominent. In this area of Cain, the third generation had the problem of a pride of spiritual relationship. We are gods. We can take upon us the name of God. We are the chosen, the elect. Look at Noah. Third generation from Noah through Ham is Nimrod. In Genesis 11:4, we find the Tower of Babel discussed, built by Nimrod. And they said, go to, let us build us a city and a tower whose top may reach unto heaven. And let us make us a name, lest we be scattered apart upon the face of the whole earth. Genesis 11:4. Sometimes we get the thought, hear the thought that they built the tower so they'd be so high that new floodwaters would not cover them. But where did they build the tower? In the valley. The mountains were higher than the tower was. The tower would not cover them, save them from flood, any more than the mountains would save them. What is the thought of the tower? Why did they build the tower? Let us make us a name, lest we be scattered. In God's plan, we realize that the patriarch of this time was Shem. Shem, some think, was Melchizedek, others do not. Shem, some think, was instrumental in building the pyramid, others do not. But Shem was the prominent figure. And Shem was of an opposite line than Nimrod. Nimrod came from the line of Ham. Let's look at the word name. The word name is Strong's 8034. Shem. Let us make us a Shem, as we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. Is it God had a Shem as the leader of the one group? We'll have our own Shem. We'll have the own center of unity. We'll have a tower, not to save them from a flood, but a tower so large that the people, as they scattered abroad and began farming outside the city, could always see this tower in the center and come back to the center. They began building a new center for themselves. Their problem was a pride in accomplishments. Look what we have done. We have made our own Shem. We made our own name. Third example, Moses. Moses' son was Gershom and Eliezer. Gershom's son was Jonathan. In Judges 18:30, I'm reading from the American Standard Version, says the children of Dan set up for themselves the graven image, and Jonathan, the son of Gershom, the son of Moses, he and his sons were priests to the tribe of the Danites until the day of the captivity of the land. Dan formed an apostasy. They needed a priest for their apostasy. And who becomes this priest? The third generation from Moses. Jonathan. Adam Clark notes that instead of the word Manasseh, which is in the King James, the word should be read Moshe or Moses, as it is found in some manuscripts, and in the oldest manuscript that's translated out of the Greek original language is the Vulgate, the Latin Vulgate. It has Moses. Here we find a problem in the third generation of a pride in spiritual roots. I am the descendant of Moses. I'm the great leader. I am heir to his fortunes. I'm heir to his position in leading the people. David, third generation is Rehoboam. You remember Solomon, his father, was a great builder. He built a temple. He built a house for the queens. He built a house for himself. He had a fleet of ships built, a very prominent building. Building costs money. To raise money, he increased taxes. Taxes cost the people money. And so when Rehoboam comes in, the people ask for the taxes to be lowered. He says, thy father made our yoke grievous. Now therefore, make thou the grievous service of thy father, and his heavy yoke which he put upon us lighter, and we will serve thee. And he recalled Rehoboam talked to his older counselors, and they said, yes, that's a good idea. The load is too heavy. But the younger counselor said, you must show them authority. You must show them as king. We read about this in 1 Kings 12, 14 to 16. He spake to them after the counsel of the young men, saying, my father made your yoke heavy, and I will add to your yoke. My father also chastised you with whips, but I will chastise you with scorpions. Whereupon the king hearkened not unto the people, for the cause was from the Lord, that he might perform his saying, which the Lord spake by Ahijah the Shilonite unto Jeroboam the son of Nebat. So when all Israel saw that the king hearkened not unto them, people answered the king, saying, what portion have we in David? Neither have we inherited the son of Jesse. To your tents, O Israel. Now see to thine own house, David. So Israel departed unto their tents. The refusal to lighten the load caused a division, a split in Israel, a split that was there until the days of the captivity into Babylon. It reminds me of, this is the wrong quotation, that should be Matthew 23. Sorry about the quote, go to the top. Of the scribes and Pharisees, Jesus said, they bind heavy burdens, the grievous to be borne, and they lay them on men's shoulders, but they themselves will not move them with one of their fingers. Here was a pride of position. I am king. I would tell what you should do. You must obey. And there was a say, if you do not obey, you will leave us. And they said, rather than be forced into obedience, we will leave. And the kingdom was split into two parts. Let's go to Jesus. The first generation of Jesus was the 12 apostles. But after they died, the church came into bad times with the bishops that came in, using great authority. We have a little parable that may help in understanding this. In Matthew 13:25, the parable of the wheat and tares, it says, "While men slept, the enemy came and sowed tares among the wheat and went his way." Notice when the tares were sown. While men slept. Sometimes we think of this as, well, that's a time element. After the apostles fell asleep. I prefer the thought of Brother Russell that he gives in Reprint 3:7-6:9. Satan did a sowing of tares while the entire church slept in the sense of not being wide awake to their duties and privileges. The church had called it a sleeping position. They didn't want to think for themselves. They let the clergy do the thinking for them. In fact, you got this in the third position at the seals of Revelation, Revelation 6:5-6. When he opened the third seal, I heard the third beast say, "Come and see." And I beheld, and lo, a black horse. And he that sat on him had a pair of balances in his hand. And I heard a voice in the midst of the four beasts saying, "A measure of wheat for a penny, three measures of barley for a penny. And see thou hurt not the oil nor the wine." The church historian Mosheim, I think, explained this thought very well. He said that as the church began to develop, after the apostles fell asleep, there was no authority to tell them what was right and what was wrong. They had different divisions of thought. They had the Gnostics, they had the monasticists, they had different groupings in the church. Each one saying, "This is true, this is true." And so the bishops got together and said, "We will tell them what is true. We will make a creed. And this creed will weigh out of it. Three measures of barley for a penny. You can have this much truth. The Bible itself will lock to the pulpit. But truth will be rationed out." The problem of the third generation here is a problem of creeds and clerical authority, where what was true was dictated by the followings of the men before them. They gave them the law. So you don't need to think for yourself. We will do your thinking for you. A few years ago, we had a sister from Eastern Europe living with us, and she was going to college. And I was asking her, I said, "What's the difference between European colleges and American colleges?" And I found her answer very interesting. She said, "There's a great difference. In Europe, we learn by rote. We memorize tables, we memorize formulas, we memorize the history before us. In America, we have to discuss these things. We have to debate them in class, the rights and wrongs." As a result, European students have a much higher grade average than American students. They learn their tables. But they have fewer scientists. They have fewer willing to challenge the position that is in the past. They've not been taught to think. They've been taught to memorize. This happened in the third generation of the church. They were not taught to think. They were taught to memorize. Years ago in our class, we had a study, and Brother Leonard Wessel, who was a teacher, said the most important thing a teacher can teach is to teach his students how to think. If he only teaches facts, the student can never rise above the teacher. But if he teaches to think, knowledge can increase, and he can go above the teacher. The Reformation. When the Reformers died, there was what was called the confessionalists in the Protestant denominations, and the Catholics, the Inquisitors, and the Counter-Reformation. Then came a group called the Pietists, a third generation. And Pietism was an interesting movement. We read about this, I'm quoting from the internet this time. Pietism was a reaction against an alternative to the dead orthodoxy that had come to dominate both the Reformed and Lutheran churches. In other words, in the Reformed and Lutheran churches, they said, "We are good because we believe in justification by faith. They do not believe in justification by faith, therefore they're bad. A single litmus test. You believe this, you're good. You don't believe this, you're not good." This caused a great division among the people because many believed a lot of things but were advancing in their knowledge and going further than that. In the first volume forward, Brother Russell says, "The problem with the Reformation was the people built fences around the Reformers. They went as far as the Reformer went and they stopped. Pietism challenged that. It was founded by a man called John Jacob Spener. And Spener was a priest, not a priest, a minister in the Lutheran Church. He would give his talks usually on character development, and then he would invite the congregation to his house in the evening to discuss the talk. And he called that collegius pietatis. a college for the study of pietism, of the application of truth in life. If truth is not applied, it is dead orthodoxy. Or I like another expression that Brother Kenneth Rawson uses. It's one of my favorites. Sterile intellectualism. Intellectualism that does not produce anything. Howard Holtzman writes, "The Church of Ephesus in Revelation was characterized by dead orthodoxy that had intellectual grasp of the truth, but was loath to apply the truth to this knowledge of life. In the third generation from the Reformation, he developed what was called a we-they syndrome. We are the good guys, they are the bad guys. And this was a very divisive influence. An influence we have to always resist ourselves. As we say, we are good because we believe this, they are bad because they don't believe this. Unthinking dead orthodoxy was the problem of the third generation. Now let's come to the harvest. And I've been arbitrary here in distinguishing the generations, but I would say the second generation, those that still had people who knew Brother Russell and had some knowledge of his vision, were around about the 1950s, late 1940s, 1950s. Then they pretty much started decreasing in number. We come to the third generation from 1950 to pretty much the present time. I'm probably the youngest, one of the youngest of this generation. I didn't know Brother Russell, but I did know those who knew him. Many of the younger ones out there in the audience, you may have known somebody who knew Brother Russell. You've been a generation further. So I'm using this as my arbitrary distinguishing. Although it applies to an earlier church, the message to Sardis applies very much to this third generation. Unto the angel of the church in Sardis write, These things saith he that hath the seven spirits of God and the seven stars. I know thy works, that thou hast a name that thou livest, but are dead. A name that thou livest, but are dead. That's picked up in the Church of Laodicea. I know thy works, that thou art neither cold nor hot. I would thou were cold or hot. So because thou art lukewarm, neither cold nor hot, I will spew thee out of my mouth. Because thou sayest, I am rich, and increased with goods, and have no need of nothing, and knowest not that thou art wretched and miserable and blind and poor and naked. It's so easy, brethren, for us in the third generation to say, I am rich, I have the truth, I have the knowledge. But is that what it's all about? Do we have a name that we live, and do we have death in our midst? There's a threefold antidote for that problem. I counsel thee to buy of me gold tried in the fire, that thou mayest be rich, and white garment that thou mayest be clothed, that the shame of thy nakedness do not appear, and anoint thine eyes with eye salve that thou mayest see. As many as I love, I rebuke and chasten. Be zealous therefore and repent. So there are three problems this third generation has. You have the problem that you need to buy gold tried in the fire. You don't have the riches. That gold is character tried in the fire. All the knowledge we have, all the information, if it does not produce a tried and true character, one that is tested, one that is characterized by crystallization, is of little value to us. He counsels us to buy the white raiment of justification, not to rely upon our methods of saying we're righteous. This and that makes me righteous, but to rely on the Lord for righteousness in all our cases, to realize in the best of situations, we're all wrong. I like the thought very much of that. It's in the question book. Brother Russell says, was asked the question, why do you call yourselves truth people? And his answer was, not because we have the truth, but because the truth is the greatest goal we're searching for. There is absolute truth. Unfortunately, you don't have it and I don't have it. It's a goal that we seek for. It's an aim. We need to rely on the justification that comes in our Lord. And the eye salve of humility. You recall how that eye salve was made that cured the blind man? He took mud, dirt from the ground, spit on it, put it on his eyes. To take that kind of treatment from anybody, it takes great faith in the healer. It takes great humility. And I'd be careful if my doctor said, I'm going to put some mud on your eye after I spit on it. I think I said, well, I'm going to get a second opinion first. I'm not quite sure I want to do that. But that humility is necessary. We need to be willing to learn. Do you ever find that you're in a discussion with somebody and you don't agree? that you're trying so hard to prove your point. You don't listen to see if you're wrong. Sometimes we need to listen and have the humility to say, oh, I can learn also. The pride is spiritual prosperity. The time is urgent, brethren, that we apply these lessons in our lives. In John 9, 4, and 5, and I'm quoting the American Standard Version again for a reason, we must work the works of him that sent me while it is day. The night cometh when no man can work. When I am in the world, I am the light of the world. The King James reads, the first word is different. I must work the works of him that sent me. But the Greek is plural, it's we. It's not talking only about Jesus working while he was alive. It's talking about the church as well. We must work the works of him that sent us. He was the light of the world. But he said, you are the candles that are lighting the world also. We have to follow in his footsteps. This urgency is also brought forth in 2 Peter 3:11. Seeing then that all these things shall be dissolved, what manner of persons ought we to be in all holy conversation and godliness? Today we can see more than ever. The world is going up in flames around us. This picture shows it well. This is the shock and awe of the bombing of Baghdad. And we see the tremendous destruction that's there and the falling of the governments around us. This should be motivation that our time is short. Let's use what time we have to get out of our doldrums and to apply ourselves to the Christian living. Paul says in Romans 13:11, knowing that now it is high time to wake out of sleep, for now is our salvation nearer than we first believed. And again, Ephesians 5:16, redeem the time because the days are evil. And again, Colossians 4:5, walk in wisdom toward those who are without, redeeming the time. Brethren, the time is short. We can see it. Are we ready to meet the Lord? Are we ready to say, Lord, not that I have been busy in your service, but I am busy in your service. Do we have that willingness to want to be there? As one brother put it, I want to die with my boots on. In the fifth volume on page 431, Brother Busser writes, the Lord's people realize that they are in the midst of evil, the tendency of which is to absorb their energy, influence, and time in things sinful or foolish, or at least unprofitable, as compared to the more weighty interests which lie closest to their hearts as children of God. We are therefore to purchase and secure out of the evil time and apart from those unfavorable influences as large a proportion of time as may be possible for devotion to higher interests, our own spiritual sustenance and strengthening, and for the assistance of others in spiritual things. Such purchase will cost us something of self-denial and gratification of our own natural appetites and desires. We need to be on the alert, brethren, that we are sacrificing what time we can, buying it back from worldly pursuits. We all have this problem, I as much as anybody else. This is the story of the parable of the talents. He who had received one talent came to the Lord and said, I knew that thou art a hard man, reaping where thou hast not sown and gathering where thou hast not strawed. And I was afraid and went and hid my treasure talent in the earth. Lo, here thou hast that is thine. His Lord answered and said, thou wicked and slothful servant, thou knowest that I reap where I sowed not, and gatherest where I have not strawed. Thou oughtest therefore to put my money to the exchangers, and then at my coming I should receive my own with usury. Take therefore the talent from him, and give it unto him that hath 10 talents. I'd like to notice 2 things in this parable. One, what the one talent servant did. He hid it in the earth. Very different from the parable of the pounds, where he put it in a white napkin and laid it aside. Here he puts it in the earth. And second, what the Lord said to him, if you couldn't make money with my talent, you could have put it in the bank. What's the bank? Well, bank, brethren, is a place where many people put their money, pool their money, so that what they could not earn individually, they can earn collectively. Our bank, I would suggest, is the ecclesia. We can join our talents in the ecclesia efforts. We can work together as a class. We can multiply our efforts and do more probably that way than singly. That's the least we can do. We should be active individually, but if not, at least with the ecclesia. How do we bear our talents? Well, some bear them in worldly pursuits. Some in their job say, well, I can work 50 hours a week and earn more, 60 hours and get more. I can get promotion. Some in parenthood, becoming so involved with their children that It cuts into their time. Not that they shouldn't be involved in parenthood. That's a very important thing. Some in materialism. Some in leisure. Some in sports. Some in education. Some in hobbies. Some in gardening. Some in television. Ouch. Some on the internet. That's one of my big places I bury my talent. I get surfing and I keep surfing. Using a time there instead of more profitable things. We must be careful not to use these things to bury our talents, but use our talents in the Lord's service. Years ago, I gave a very brash talk. I was young and I wasn't too wise. I gave a talk on Where Are the Dead. I said, well, what's so brash about that? Well, the way I started out was very brash. I used the scripture, wake thou that sleepest and rise from the dead. And I said, where are the dead? And my next sentence was, right here in this audience. Well, that wasn't a very tactful thing to say. At least it wasn't politically correct. It wasn't, however, necessarily wrong. We have to watch out that we are not the dead, that we are not the sleeping ones, not those that give the adversary a time to sow his terrors. In that talk, I mentioned that dead people have tombstones, and they put epitaphs on the tombstone. We can put epitaphs on. We can say, I regularly went to the meetings. That's nice. That's very nice. We can say, I read the volumes every day. Or I always witnessed. I took every opportunity to witness. I was an elder. I had an office in the church. All of these are nice epitaphs to put on our tombstone. But they're not the epitaph you want. They're not the epitaph I want. We want the epitaph of Caleb. Remember what Caleb's epitaph was? He hath wholly followed the Lord. That's the epitaph we want. Not for any single thing we did, but wholly following the Lord, being totally involved. There was a Christian back in the 19th century who tried to put this epitaph on his tombstone. You know the name, Dwight Moody. And he wrote, the world is yet to see what can be accomplished by one man wholly devoted to God. I aim to be that man. A very lofty goal. Let us also aim to be that man. Let us take the idealism of consecration and say, others may. I cannot do some things others do. I must give my life wholly to the Lord. I must fully sacrifice to the dying day to try to seek what I can do in the Lord's service. I know I've got obligations, those must be met. But beyond those obligations, to fully serve the Lord. My problem in the talk, when I said the dead are right here in this audience, was I forgot the three fingers pointed back at me. And I was quizzing myself as well. I didn't recognize it at the time. I was even more guilty than the audience. Apostle Paul says to himself, thou art an excusable man. Whosoever thou art that judges. For wherein thou judgest another, thou condemnest thyself. For thou that judgest doest the same things. And yes, I was guilty. Paul said to himself, now, I keep under my body, I'm bringing it into subjection, lest that by any means, when I preach to others, I myself should be a castaway. No, we can't afford to point the finger at others. We need to point it at ourselves as well. All of us are guilty of these things. Remind me of a story my boss told me of the druggist and hardware man. As most of you know, I spent my life working for newspapers. Worked in an editorial department for a while, then in advertising. And my boss told me that when he first started his paper, he had a partner. And they needed to get advertising. So when you start a paper and get advertising, you naturally go to the Chamber of Commerce meetings. Well, he found out there what I found out there, too. Chamber of Commerce meetings are inherently selfish. Each person is there for what he can get out of the chamber, not for what he can do for the chamber. They're willing to work if it's going to increase their bottom line. But if it's going to help their store down the street, they're not interested. So my boss wrote a scathing editorial, blasting these people for their selfishness in the chamber. His partner said, this week you're selling the ads. I'm not going on the street. So my boss went to the druggist. And the druggist said, you know, that was a great editorial you wrote. I hope the hardware man read it. And, of course, the hardware man said, I really like that. I hope the druggist read it. When we read these things, we apply these things. Do we apply them to ourselves or do we apply them to the druggist and the hardware man down the street? When I was a teenager, graduating from high school, it was a different school system than we have today. Religion was in the schools. We had not only prayer in schools, but at my graduation we had a sermon. And this was testimony in our town. They called it a baccalaureate sermon. The congregational minister gave the sermon, and his scripture was Romans 12:11 from the Moffat translation. Maintain the spiritual glow. You'll recognize the King James, fervent in spirit. But he liked this thought of maintaining the spiritual glow. And in his sermon, he used three lamps. Took an old kerosene lamp, and he lit it. And a puff of fire went up. And then it simmered down to almost nothing. Not much light was given. It burned itself out in the first minute of lighting. He says they finally improved that lamp and made a lamp that glows steadily. It didn't give a lot of light, but it glows steadily. At least it was using itself over a period of time. And then they went to the modern kerosene lamp, where it lit and stayed lit. So these represent three choices we had as graduating students. So are you going to burn out, or are you going to be the miler, who's prepared for the long run? He quoted the scripture where Ahab says, let him that put on the harness boast not, as him that taketh it off. Very important for us, brethren, too, that it is not what we have done, but what are we doing? One of my first general conventions was at Chautauqua. And Brother Blinn, Horace Blinn, was the testimony leader. I was about 13, 14 years old at the time. And brethren were just coming out of the society, and they were just getting organized. And one brother after another would testify, I have been consecrated for 25 years. I've been consecrated for 30 years. I've been consecrated for 10 years. I've been consecrated for 40 years. And finally, Brother Blinn said, Brother, the question is, have you been consecrated? Is you consecrated? Many of us here have been immersed. Many of us many years back. My immersion was back over 50 years. That is no value. It's, you know, applying it today. The dying words of Brother John Edgar was, daily renew your consecration and daily seek to fulfill it. So I'm part of the third generation of Bible students. What have my legacy been and my generations to you who are the younger ones, the fourth generation? We left you a splintered movement. We left you a movement that's full of discussions and sterile intellectualism, arguments over words, arguments over minor points. We left you with a movement unwilling to hear truth challenged, but says, repeat the old, old story. We left you with a feeling of an attitude of superiority. We left you with the reluctance to show love to those we disagree with. We left you with a slackened zeal from our own younger days. In my younger days in Chicago, we used to get together every Saturday, and we put out 50,000 tracks a week. Put them out so fast that Don couldn't keep up with the printing them. We had to get our own press to keep printing. We get them in time, and we separate them out. We print during the week, we put them out on weekends. Then we go out follow-upping. There was a zeal that was there. But as we got older, technology improved. We didn't need to go out. We could do it electronically. And that's great. We can reach many people. But it's got its downside. We need the personal activity. We need the personal involvement. We need our service meetings in our classes. We have been a poor example of maintaining the spiritual glow. In other words, my generation owes your younger generation a deep apology. What we've done. But now, what of the fourth generation? Those of you who are coming up behind us, you've got two choices. You can accept the status quo and maintain what you've got inherited. And if you do, you're going to become another denomination. You're going to become just another group splintered off. Or you can go back and return to the vision of the first generation and say, let's go back and let's try to recapture that spirit that Brother Russell had. The spirit of a vision of a kingdom message that reached everybody in the world. Brethren, we have the most beautiful message there is in the life, in the world. A kingdom for all people. Every man, woman, living child. That's a message to tell to the nations. A message of love, truth, and light. To the fourth generation, I say, stand you in the ways. Ask for the old paths. Where is the good way? Walk therein and you should find rest for your souls. But they said, we will not walk therein. Brethren, do not say that. Go back to the vision of the first generation, to that search for truth, that willingness to challenge, that willingness to have a broad view of those who disagree with, that willingness to call Moody, Brother Moody, and Lincoln, Brother Lincoln, that spirit that reached out, and that was not just reaching inward, was not proud of its accomplishments, but was looking forward to new accomplishments. Maintain the spiritual glow. And finally, I leave you with, I got one more section here to cover real shortly. It says, don't hide your light under a bushel. Not only is the light unseen, but starved of oxygen, the light goes out under a bushel. What is a bushel? It's a basket. You put wheat in it. The ecclesia is like a bushel. It's a basket that holds wheat. If you only let your light shine forth in the ecclesia, unchallenged, you'll stifle truth. Truth grows by being challenged. Truth grows by being forced to go back and prove and reprove its roots. We must not be Dead Sea Christians. All intake and no outgo. And now, my end, finally. 1 Corinthians 28:10. A literal translation. David speaking to Solomon. To the people, rather. Take heed now. For the Lord has chosen thee to build a house for the sanctuary. Be strong and be doing. Yes, brethren, be strong and be doing. Use your energies. Carl, use your energy for the Lord. We all have our shortcomings here. We all have a goal to fight. We all need to go back to the consecration of values and idealism we had when we were dipped under the water that time in our life. We offered our consecration. Let us maintain that idealism.